I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is founder of Aftelier Perfumes, Mandy Aftel. She's joined in conversation by chef and restaurateur Daniel Patterson. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Mandy Aftel and Daniel Patterson.
Mandy Aftel has been handcrafting natural perfumes for over 20 years. She's formerly a psychotherapist for artists and writers. She launched Aftelier Perfumes in 1997. She blends each of her perfumes from a collection of over 600 scents culled from flowers, spices, grasses, barks, and resins. She's sourced these distillations from around the world, working with farmers and producers and honoring pure aromas. Mandy isn't just an artisan, she's a true student of her art. Unsurprisingly, she's an author and authority. Fragrant is her seventh book. Her other books include Essence and Alchemy, A Natural History of Perfume, Scents and Sensibilities, and Aroma, a book she and Daniel Patterson co-wrote in 2004 about the role fragrance plays in food. When other chefs around the country showed interest, she assembled a collection of edible and potable potions, Aftelier Chef's Essences, which are now used by chefs and mixologists around the country. Three of Mandy's fragrances have been nominated for the U.S. Fifi Awards, the perfume industry's equivalent of the Oscars. The first time an all-natural perfume has been nominated for a Fifi since the award began in 1973. And among her many accolades, Mandy was named one of the top seven bespoke perfumers in the world by Forbes. Appearing in conversation with Mandy this evening is her longtime friend and co-author, chef, restaurateur, and food writer, Daniel Patterson. Daniel's restaurant group, DPG, now oversees four locations, Qua, Alta in San Francisco, Plum Bar, and Haven in Oakland. His flagship, two Michelin star restaurant Qua, was recognized among the world's 50 best restaurants, and Daniel was awarded Best Chef West by the James Beard Foundation in 2014. His most recent book, Qua, Stories and Recipes, was published in October 2013. Ladies and gentlemen, Mandy Aftel and Daniel Patterson.
Hi. Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Really excited to be here and really excited to talk with Mandy about her book. But this is an amazing book. It's beautiful, in addition to being incredibly well-written, well-put-together, and a storyline that for me, flows really in an amazing way. So I thought I'd start by kind of talking a little bit about our relationship and why I'm here. So in 2001, Mandy had written a book called Essence and Alchemy. Mandy decided she wanted to work with a chef to kind of explore a little bit more about the food world. She's a interest and flavor, and the relationship between what we smell and what we taste is so close that it seemed very natural. So a mutual friend introduced us, and she came by in 2001. I had a restaurant then, and she just brought over a bunch of the essential oils that she was working with and totally blew me away. Like, I'd never seen an essential oil before. This is a kind of product that's been used for literally thousands of years that has almost completely disappeared from modern usage. So she brought these things, which were exactly what the ingredient is, and then somehow more dimension, more intensity, more clarity. And she said, let's do a book together. So it was great. I had no idea what to do with them. So there was no template, there was no book about cooking with essential oils, even though they'd always traditionally been used in drinks and in food. And that's something that Mandy's going to get into a little later, is a little bit of the history of them. So anyway, we wrote a book together called Aroma, which was really amazing. And still, like, I travel a lot. And so when I see friends in kitchens around the world, I'll see that book actually pretty often, because a lot of chefs picked it up and they realized that, especially within kind of the new cocktail culture that's evolved, these are very powerful tools to create flavor. And now we're working on a new book, which is about flavor, which seems like the next thing after you talk about aroma, you talk about flavor, which I'm really excited about that. So one thing I want to kind of start out with is this idea of a natural perfumer, which I was kind of struck by as well, like as opposed to unnatural. But actually, most perfume that's sold in the world is created synthetically. There's almost no natural perfume in the world, which is really incredible. It's as if 99.9% of all the food sold in the world was McDonald's or something. But you'd pay like $100 for a hamburger. That's like what the perfume world is. So what we're going to do is we're going to pass out some scent strips throughout the talk. But this first one, you're going to get two strips to smell. One is of a synthetic jasmine, and one is of a natural jasmine. My guess is you'll be able to tell the difference pretty quickly. But the difference is actually one is kind of beautiful and sumptuous and very, very complex. And the other is a lot simpler and more direct. So I was in a scientist's lab one time, and he was showing me one of these instruments that there's maybe 10,000 individual aromatic molecules that go into a scent like jasmine is. Any kind of organic material, the way it smells, there's 2, 3, 4 primary elements to that are dominant. But what makes it natural is all of the other stuff about it. So they figured out how to synthesize those 2 or 3 or 4 elements. And that's what you're smelling, is the difference between like the complexity of life and this kind of caricature. I mean, so, you know, how did you, when you were starting to put these things together, obviously you didn't have very much of a roadmap. So how did you make your way forward in terms of your way of constructing perfumes in a completely natural form? And how did you even get to that place, I guess?
But I'm going to answer that in 1 second. When you get your two little scent strips, what you should find in the synthetic, the natural one, is it has a lot of layers of smell. If you can kind of wrap your imagination around the idea that there could be layers inside there of complexity, and kind of there is something in the natural jasmine that's kind of yin and yang, that's kind of putrid and beautiful. And it's all about, in perfume really, about how the ugly mixes with the beautiful, like in life. So how I figured out to make perfume, you know, I taught myself and I figured it out, but I kind of don't totally understand how I got there, because I'm not scientific. When I see some stuff about me as being like a chemist or being scientific, I always think like, oh my God, it's so wrong. In perfume, there are these kind of three levels of materials called top notes, middle notes, and base notes. And in the natural world, that's incredibly important for natural essences. And what they relate to is how long you can smell them. A perfume is kind of a work of art that evolves in time. So the top notes disappear very quickly. They reach your sense of smell quickly. They're kind of sharp and pointy smells. They have come from the world of citruses and herbs. They're inexpensive. And they're the greeting you get when you smell a perfume. The middle notes have much more layers. Jasmine is a middle note. It has these layers of different smells in them. They can last for between 2 and 4 hours. And they're the next thing you smell, although it's not evenly divided. And then the base notes are roots and barks and trees and resins. They're the materials that have been in man's spiritual life since the beginning of time. And they can last for days. And I feel that for me, to make perfume, it's been really dependent on understanding the materials from the inside, which is really no different than you and food. each material to me, each essence has its own identity, has its own capacities, has its own intensity. And when I put them together, I think of them as like, you know, they're going to get along, they're not going to get along. Much like you would do a dinner, I think of with my perfumes about how to make them work. And then with natural perfumes, I think it's a lot harder actually to make a perfume than with synthetics, because synthetic perfume can last a long time. Natural perfume doesn't last long on the skin. For better and for worse, this place will not smell like Macy's by the time we leave. It's, natural essences are a little bit like, you know, a baguette. They're here and then they disappear.
So just to kind of go backwards for
yes.
one second, what is an essence technically?
Essences can come in different forms. So one is an essential oil, which comes from the product of distillation, which is where you put plant material in a vessel, and then you put either hot water or steam, and the oil that comes out of the plant, the thing that makes flavor and fragrance is the essential oil that's in the plant. That's what makes for flavor or fragrance. So when you take an herb and you you rip it up like basil and stuff and it's on your fingers, that's the oil. That's the transmission of the oil to your fingers or into a pasta sauce, let's say. So it, that oil...
Or like lemon zest.
With lemon zest, exactly. The oil of a lemon is in the peel. So if you push on the peel, you'll get the oil on your hands. And long ago, which I found out in the book, which was kind of great, they used to do this thing, I mean like hundreds of years ago, where they would rub the lemon with a piece of sugar. They rubbed the skin, and then the sugar, probably was terrific actually, was just filled with this citrus oil. And then they'd do stuff with it when they were like baking or cooking or making drinks, and it was just kind
That's
of romantic.
A great idea.
Yeah, it was kind of totally, it's called oleosacrum. And it's because I did all this research.
So like taking rock sugar and rubbing it into a piece of citrus and then dropping it into a drink or something.
Yeah, it was probably really beautiful. You know,
or tea.
Yeah, or tea. It would probably be fantastic. And then there were other stuff, too, where they did that with sugar with ambergris, where they would rub it on. Sugar was a medium. I mean, before sugar, well, kind of before everything became so common, it was fascinating and wild and interesting, which is kind of what I think of as the oils being this way to this fantastical universe that we somewhat take for granted and the smells of it. So sugar was this amazing place that you could put essential oils, and it was kind of very interesting and precious and rare.
You know, you mentioned tea, and it's really interesting because I feel like a lot of times the sense of smell and the sense of taste in people's minds will be separate, mm-hmm. and then this whole book becomes very foreign.
Yes,
you know, I don't
totally.
Really think like that. I don't understand. It's kind of, but we do that every day with something like tea, right?
Yes. I think the most aromatic experiences people really have are with the drinks. I think drinks are incredibly aromatic experiences, that people take tea or they take coffee or hot chocolate or mixed drinks or wine and they hold them up to their nose. When they drink them, they smell them. The whole world of wine is around, you know, the vocabulary of those smells, or the world of tea. And I think that it's no fluke how convivial those experiences are, and all the cups and glasses and, you know, accoutrement, all the stuff that goes with it, because it's so, the aromatic aspect of it is so pleasureful and so social and so something that you share. So I feel like people have these very aromatic experiences with drinks, and that it's kind of a bridge from my world to yours, which is how people are very involved with the smells of the things they drink, and then, of course, very involved with the smells of the things they're cooking.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, you're talking about beauty. So
yeah.
the book is organized into five aromas, and each one kind of represents something different. So jasmine is in the book, and the chapter of jasmine is about beauty, but... It reminded me, I was reading it again today, and it reminded me of the end of a Stephen Dunn poem. So Stephen Dunn is a poet who wrote a poem called Privilege of Ordinary Heartbreak. It's, anyway, I just want to read it. Today the odor of lilacs outside my window is half perfume, half something rotten. That's just how they smell and what I'm used to. One thing and always the disturbing insistence of another. Fat life itself. Too much to let in, too much to turn away. So, you know, this idea of beauty in your book and in the making of a perfume, I really love the way you talked about the complexity of this, you know, half perfume, half something rotten. And I think jasmine really seems to embody that in a way. So when you think about beauty, and when you think about beauty particularly within the context of smell, how do you find that complexity within that?
Well, jasmine is the perfect example of the kind of that was a beautiful poem, beautiful piece of work. Jasmine is so interesting because a piece of jasmine is something called indole, which is very skanky, funky smell that's inside of jasmine and inside of the most precious flowers, and it's also in feces. And so it's, if you want an example of something that's both, you know, I think of that Yeats one where it says, Crazy Jane and the Bishop, where he says, man has pitched his tent, and I can't remember the exact phrase. But the whole chapter on jasmine is about beauty, but it's about a kind of beauty that they think about in Japanese society called wabi-sabi, which is about the beauty of aging and the beauty of things falling apart and the beauty of sadness. And so I think of beauty as encompassing that very deep well, as not being a piece of something superficial, but having that kind of depth, that yin and yang. And jasmine is kind of the poster child for that, and then it's got this fecal and floral aspect to it. So when I think of creating, you know, a perfume, which I do. I have a little artisanal perfume line where I make things. I always think about kind of that other side of it. I wouldn't say I make things that much that are just pretty. I have a few. You know, if someone would call, I make everything myself. My perfume line is tiny. And if someone calls and gets me on the phone, you know, and I usually will start with the stuff that's kind of pretty, and then if they seem adventurous, I move along to the weirder and weirder stuff that I've made, which I personally think is much prettier than the simpler, more beautiful stuff that I make. It's not kind of for everybody, but for me, beauty takes in the depth and the sadness of life. You know, it's a very rich experience, the experience of beauty.
And it also encompasses this idea of the transience. So
yes,
beauty... In a person's life, there's an arc.
Yes.
And so that's one of the things that you talked about, and you kind of touched on it before, which fascinates me, this idea, rather than, for example, synthetic, which is going to be from the first time you smell it till the last time you smell it, which is going to be actually quite a while. You know, you walk into an elevator and someone with really heavy perfume has been on like two floors before you, and it's like walking into this ghost. But it's like a really not a very nice smelling ghost, and you have to wear it around you and then you leave. But that experience of engaging with that scent is exactly the same in the beginning, the middle, and the end, which is very different about natural perfume. So when you put it on, first of all, it smells differently on everyone. It reacts to everyone's body chemistry, and then it starts one way and then it changes, and then it's incredibly beautiful as it dies. And I love that part of the metaphor.
I do too. I mean, I really...
And how it relates, in fact, to flowers, which the whole chapter is about flowers, which is kind of what a flower's life is like.
And also life. You know, I mean, it's life is like that. There's certainly a lot of reason to love, you know, natural perfume and a little, you know, soapbox to stand on about it all. But to me, it's just beautiful. I mean, really, it's you know, there's health issues and all kinds of things, but a natural essence has a smell that nothing else has, and it has this arc, and it brings with it that incredible history with us as people across the globe, everywhere, across time. And in the book, one of the things that was a complete thrill for me, I mean, I read 150 books to write this book, and the stories that I uncovered about natural essences were so completely fascinating. I mean, they were just so rich and so exciting, just the stuff I turned over, it was hard to figure out which ones would make it into the book and which ones I'd have to kind of leave behind. And it was kind of great because I was sort of worried I wouldn't have enough, and it turned out I had way too much. But the stories were just so enlivened, not only the essences, but like my life, that I felt like, wow, I really want to share this world I've stumbled into and that I'm in a lot with other people, because it's like kind of literally under your nose, which cinnamon was a big thing about, but you don't kind of really notice it. So my hope was that people would notice this more and have more kind of more pleasure in their lives through their sense of smell. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to founder of Aftelier Perfumes, Mandy Aftel, whose book is Fragrant, The Secret Life of Scent. She's joined in conversation by chef and restaurateur Daniel Patterson on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Again, kind of getting back to this idea of what beauty is, mm-hmm. I love the idea that embraces more than just kind of a surface prettiness, I think within our society we've evolved so much towards a worship of this kind of surface prettiness without embracing the complexity of people, which is kind of beautiful.
There was a wonderful Japanese term that I read about when I was doing the research on the wabi-sabi called mano no aware, which is about that there's a sadness in beauty, that at the core of beauty there's a sadness, and this term, this particular term, speaks to that. And it's the fleetingness of beauty, and Baudelaire speaks of that as well, that's a piece of what makes beauty beautiful. So to hold on to it forever is to make it less beautiful.
But there's, at the same time, when I go to your house with all of the amazing essences there, you'll have like a 90-year-old coriander. So one of the phrases that I loved in the book was the gift of time. So this idea that even the essence itself starts one way and evolves. So how do you work with different ages of things? How do they change over time?
I went in this antique store in Berkeley, and I got an old bottle of essential oil that was 100 years old. It just was there, and I bought it. And I had a friend at this very big perfume house called IFF. It's probably the biggest ones in the world. Very famous perfumer. And I told him I'd found this like bottle. It was antique cassia, which is a kind of cinnamon. And he said, "Just throw it out. It'll be bad. It'll have gone bad." So I thought, he knows. Because he knows, he's a big deal perfumer. And I'm sitting in my house making stuff by myself. So I thought, well, and we had a little beaten top, it had a little metal on the top over the cork, and it was all beaten and so cute, never been opened. So I thought, oh, before I throw it out, I'm sure in a fairy tale I would have been, burned. I open it up and I get it out, and it was so unbelievable. It was the most unbelievable cinnamon smell on earth. It had layers and levels, and I thought, boy, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. So from then on, I went on the hunt, which was a good thing because I don't think I could do it anymore because too many other people are onto this. I have lots of 100-year-old oils. I have a lot of them, and I'm working toward making a little museum of them. And they're amazing. They're so fascinating. A lot of them turn bad. Some turn bad. But some of them age like these great wines, and they just have these worlds in them. And they're just exciting and phenomenal. I have 100-year-old sandalwood, for example. And I have a pretty big bottle of it. And it's just rich and creamy and alive and wonderful. And when I do my custom perfumes, I do these one-of-a-kind perfumes for people. I do put the 100-year-old oils in them. And then, speaking of the fleetingness of beauty, when they're gone, they're going to be gone. Like, I won't have any more.
There's One of the things that I just loved is he put in quotes by Agnes Martin, who's like one of my favorite artists ever.
Yeah.
But one particularly, you know, along the lines of the transience that really struck me was she said the function of artwork is the stimulation of sensibilities, the renewal of memories of moments of perfection. I thought that was a really nice way to kind of capture that echo of an echo. So kind of moving on, like another chapter that really, like for me, was kind of revelatory because it's so common, but I learned so much out of it, was mint. So the idea of mint being so closely related to the home and to hospitality and how it's linked, it's in so many things. You pour mint tea, mints to welcome people, you send people off with mints. So how did you kind of stumble across that? Because it's so intuitive once you write it, but it never really occurred to me.
Well, you know, as you know, I wasn't going to include, I had the four essences for the book are frankincense, jasmine, cinnamon, and ambergris, but I had four. I wasn't going to do five. And Daniel said to me, you've got to do something green. Now, which made sense, but I kind of thought, oh, that's going to be so boring. You know, I really don't want to do something green. So I began to think through, like, which green thing to do. And it was very clear to me that mint was the one. But I thought it was going to be a boring chapter, kind of a filler, not so interesting. I wouldn't have anything great to say. So I started to do research, and it turned out to have the most exciting information. I think it's the best, most interesting chapter in the book because I stumbled. Let me just stop for 1 second to explain. You're going to get two strips. You're going to get peppermint and spearmint, so you can kind of compare them. So, because it's very interesting. I have extremely good quality spearmint and peppermint. So you'll notice that the peppermint is a little bit like a candy cane. It has no bitterness. A lot of peppermint is quite bitter. This doesn't have any bitterness to it at all. And then the spearmint also has no bitterness. But what's interesting, they share in common a certain amount of menthol. The peppermint has a lot more menthol. So when you're thinking about using peppermint, you usually use it in drinks and desserts and in chocolate, whereas spearmint can be in savory or sweet. People use it for cooking. People use it in salads. People use it for dessert. It's much more useful because of its lesser amount of the menthol. So just so you can compare the two of them together, and you'll see where they overlap and kind of also where they're not the same.
Spearmint gets along with a lot of
spearmint is a happy
flavors,
camper, but peppermint is like
not so much.
Peppermint's, you know, it's got to be in just a few places, and it's very strong too. Peppermint's this very strong smell. So what I found in the mint, which was I thought was like the coolest thing, was mint was very American. There was a huge American mint industry in the Midwest, in Michigan. In fact, there was a town called Mentha, Michigan, which is a ghost town now. They had a little train station called it. You can see in some of these crazy books I found of the Mentha train station in Michigan. So when people were traveling across the country, the settlers, there were these peddlers. They were called hawkers and walkers, and there were some that just had essential oils, and they would, you know, carry them from town to town. In fact, Louisa May Alcott's father was a peddler, and he carried these essential oils. And as people were moving west, they took mint among other things with them, and they developed this huge mint industry in Michigan, which became the center for gum, chewing gum, all the mint gums, breath mints, toothpaste, the whole industry of mint.
So like Wrigley's.
Wrigley's, exactly. And you know, Beecham's, or all of them were there. But what was interesting about mint was that there was this underbelly of America in that period of time, which was quite fascinating, with the peddlers and also with these very odd books that people took across the country, which there was this kind of lunatic guy called Dr. Chase who lived in Michigan, and he had all these like secrets and recipes and fragrance recipes and ink recipes and toad recipes. And it was the second most popular book after the Bible, and it had certain essential oils, bitters, all sorts of things in it. And I found in my research that in medieval Italy, there were these things called books of secrets. And these books of secrets were a lot like Dr. Chase's remedies in terms of they had remedies, they had perfume recipes, they had ink recipes, they had household recipes. And also, when I first fell into perfume, the books for perfume were a lot like the books of secrets with this amalgam of what we would think of as holistic recipes. And there was mint like popping up in the drinks and in the food recipes and so on. So there was like this connection between, you know, kind of long ago in Italy and these very incredible books were handwritten to the perfume books of the 1890s all the way through to Dr. Chase moving the pioneers kind of across the country. And mint was the link between them. And there was this just wonderful myth, I guess, I'm not sure what to call, story from Ovid about mint that was so fantastic, kind of a little violent, but kind of fantastic, where Hermes and Zeus, the gods, they came down and went to this village in Greece, right? Greece? In Greece. And they knocked on all these people's doors, like as the Greek gods kind of tend to do. And they wanted a meal. They were hungry. And they were not dressed up like gods. They were dressed like poor people. And no one was interested in them, and no one wanted to feed them. And so they knocked at the door of this old couple named Bauchus and Philemon, and asked them to feed them. And they said yes, and they were poor. And what they did, which was so incredible and lovely, was they rubbed their table. They had a very poor home. They rubbed their table with mint leaves and to welcome them. And they gave them their finest meal, and the gods were satisfied. And then they wiped out the town pretty quickly after that and killed everyone and let these two live. And they took them, you know, up this hill and wiped everybody out, made their house a temple. And then this couple, so it pays to be fragrant. It also pays to be generous. And then they reappear in my book in the frankincense chapter. I have a chapter on trees and on frankincense. And when they're...
Is that the one they grow together?
Yes.
Oh,
so
I
in the
that.
End of the... It, I'll just tell you the end of the story because it's such a cool story. I mean, I found such cool stuff. So they have this little temple and the gods go back and do whatever. And anyway, so they're getting really old. They're going to die. So they said, what's your wish to this couple? And they said, we don't want to live 1 minute without the other one. And so they take them up to this hill, and they're saying goodbye to each other. I'm going to start crying. I have to not start crying. And they start sprouting leaves, and they turn into one tree with two roots. And that's it. So that's in the frankincense chapter, and then the mint chapter has the earlier part. And the stories about the ingredients are really kind of like that. You know, I don't think I'm so special to have this book. It's just all this interesting stuff was there.
Yeah, I mean, it's so amazing that the history that has kind of been lost out of the narrative, modern narrative of what life is. Like within the even this idea of what America was, say, 100 years ago, the drugstore, pharmacy slash, you know, they had
soda
a lot
fountain.
Of essential. So the soda fountain, so the crossover between all of those things, it was just all in the same place, right? Like, so the medicine, you'd get soda there, you'd get perfume, and it was all made with these tinctures.
The essential oils was such a through line in this, you know, for the soda fountains. There was this wonderful book about soda fountains that I read, or these, my book has these unbelievably beautiful drawings, which come from these books I found, these 1850 pharmacy books, which are amazing, and they're all using essential oil and cocaine and all kinds of other stuff too. Completely fascinating books, I must say. And you see how holistic things really were a long time ago, and that essential oils were this through line through the culture that of perfume, of food, of drinks, of so many things. And it's just got this very, very rich backstory. And I think it's because the materials are so gorgeous. You know, they're just so beautiful, and they're so lost to us now. But they're extremely beautiful materials that are really under your nose. All you have to do is kind of turn on to them.
And in a way, it's like a fresh herb and picking something. The difference between that and something that's been sitting around, something that's dried, something that's just not good. You know, it's funny. When you talk about the materials and you talk about even something like mint, which is so common, one of the things that I love that you brought out in that chapter was this idea of luxury and kind of exploring what luxury means when you have something that's so, in a way, so banal, finding luxury in quality, but in an everyday sort of sense.
Yes. Well, you know, the most interesting thing, the most interesting kind of poster child for luxury was cinnamon. You know, cinnamon is was so interesting, so interesting. People went to such great extents about cinnamon, which is now kind of an artificial flavor at Dunkin' Donuts. And so it was like how the mighty fall in such a strange way. So cinnamon was kind of the titan of the spice trade. And the spice trade was just all about, you know, getting these extraordinary smells and bringing them home. And as if cinnamon wasn't like far enough away and hard enough to get your hands on, they made up these crazy stories about where it came from, which were completely untrue, because they wanted to hide where the cinnamon came from so other people couldn't get it. So they had this one weird story among many that the cinnamon came from this tree where this bird got it somehow, the cinnamongulus, and he put it in his nest, and they would run around under the tree with joints of meat, so the bird would get interested, he'd come out of the tree, the nest would fall, and that's where cinnamon came from. Like, it wasn't, like, bad enough that they kind of sailed around the world the wrong way, Columbus, for starters, to look for cinnamon, and they would do things like, if you took a cinnamon seed, they'd cut your hand off. They weren't kidding, either. You know, they really were protecting it. It was this very luxurious thing. They would take it and they would use the cinnamon, the pieces of cinnamon, they would beat them and then they would cover them with gold and make crowns of them. And they just thought it was this amazing, amazing smell and taste. They wanted that smell and taste. And because it became so easy to get, you know, and because its connection to status changed, people stopped appreciating it. They just never saw it as, wow, this is a really fascinating smell and taste, which it is. It fell entirely out of favor because it was easy to get. And so some of the things that, you know, I talk about in the book has to do with the difference between luxury and status, and that luxury is a lot about having a sensual experience. So to me, luxury is a perfect peach. You know, if you get a peach in season or you have wonderful mint tea, that's a luxury. Luxury is not as tied to cost. Many, many costly goods are not really very luxurious. They're only full of status. And so when you have a sensual connection with something of high quality that pleases you, you're having a luxury experience.
But when you talk about that, you know, perfume being the, you know, one of the big examples. So in the book, a perfume industry person broke down what a $100 bottle of perfume goes to. And it's like bottle $6, marketing $8. There's this kind of commission and that kind of commission, and there's manufacturing. And then you get all the way down to the bottom and it's ingredients, $2. You know, and so, but if you look at the advertising, these are like some of the most glamorous products in the world in terms of how they're marketed, but there's nothing actually luxurious in them. But, you know, so in a way, what the Min chapter talked about, which I thought was really wonderful, was this idea, was the complete inverse, saying what's inside, you know, of your anything that you come across in your normal life every day can have that sense of luxury within it.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was in juxtaposition to the luxury part of the cinnamon, like a really nice sentiment for us all to have, you know, in our normal lives that we don't think about very often, especially we don't think about in relation to perfume.
Well, you know, I have my own way of doing perfume, and a lot of people, you know, don't like perfume, and I really can understand why. But it's as though most people who have an experience with perfume have kind of the McDonald's equivalent of it. Even if it's very expensive, it isn't made with truly extraordinary ingredients. And it's been like that for over 100 years. So it's not something new. It's something old. The perfume business, the major, you know, multi whatever they are, corporate big places, have steered away from using expensive ingredients since forever. No matter what they really say is in there, it isn't in there.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features founder of Aftelier Perfumes, Mandy Aftel, whose book is Fragrant, The Secret Life of Scent. She's joined in conversation by chef and restaurateur Daniel Patterson. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So for me, I fell in love with the materials, and I love doing I have a little business, and I make everything myself, and I search. I'm always on the hunt. I feel like I'm on the spice route, looking for, you know, the best version of rose and the best version of jasmine, and I really enjoy that. I mean, the stuff you're smelling is the stuff I make my perfumes with, and I love having the experience of looking for that stuff and using it much as you would as a chef, finding, you know, a perfect tomato or, you know, a perfect mushroom or something like that. I enjoy that experience, and I also enjoy doing it drop by drop. I enjoy making everything myself. I enjoy all of what I get to do. I feel incredibly lucky, but I couldn't be a big business and do what I'm doing. I couldn't. I mean, first of all, I get fired the minute I start buying the stuff I buy. I mean, they just get rid of me in 2 seconds. But I couldn't make things in the way that I am. So I feel very fortunate in a way that there's the internet and there are things like this that allow artisanal people to do things they're passionate about.
So getting back to cinnamon, which was an absolutely fascinating chapter, you wrote, the world was discovered in perfume's wake. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, people really, really wanted these ingredients. It's hard to understand how much people wanted this stuff, but they did. You know, if you ever saw that movie, what was that called? The Orchid Thief or something, where they're like all over the place? People wanted this stuff, and there was such excitement about them. Some for commerce, of course, but some was because they liked how they smelled. You know, things like ambergris and things like jasmine and rose, and people traveled all over to try to get their hands on them. And there was all these adventures and intrigue about being able to get them, and when they found them, it was completely exciting, which is what I feel I do in my own little tiny way in my life. And so there was the world, when they discovered the world, first of all, people went to great lengths to get spices into their life, something that we take for granted. Oh, the cinnamon, what I'm talking about. Cinnamon that you're getting that's going around is an extraordinarily beautiful cinnamon. I had another cinnamon that I was going to use for the book, and this is why I could never work at a big company, and I didn't like it as well as this new one I got, so I threw it out and used this one instead. This is a special extraction. It's called a carbon dioxide extraction, a CO2 extraction, and it's very uninvasive. It's without the boiling. It's done with carbon dioxide, and so it's very reminiscent of the complexity, sweet complexity of cinnamon. And because I did so much research on cinnamon, I don't go anywhere if I travel that I don't get a cinnamon roll, because I'm like this toward cinnamon now, because it's so rich to me. I just feel like it's the most exciting thing on earth. I mean, I have to say my absolute best cinnamon roll, should you ever go, was in Santa Fe. It's just a terrific cinnamon roll. But I'm really just so interested in, when you think about it and you smell it right now, if you just can smell it with a new nose, you know, with a brand new nose, not your old nose, but a new nose, and you smell it for the first time, you'll smell how sweet and woody and magical and warm that it is. You can see that, like, when people found it, they must have gone, oh my God, what is this stuff? You know, it's just extraordinary. And I think, you know, if I can encourage you to do anything, it's to smell with a new nose.
So given the history of spices and the lengths that people went to get them, and how important they were in commerce, how important they were in culture, Why is it now, do you think, that they've become so passé, like you don't see them as much in cooking? Spices have almost become relegated to the like the dusty part of the pantry.
I think that it's complex about, first of all, I think spices are really considered like for kids and dessert. Like you're going to get some like rice pudding, you know, or you know, something like that. People don't think of them as much in cooking, although if you go somewhere like Morocco, you know, they do really consider them or cumin. I think spices have fallen out of favor. I think in the world of cuisine, French cuisine really took over at a certain point, and it was all about herbs and not about spices. And I think that what's interesting about spices, and I see this so much in perfume, is when you lift one out all by itself, like if you really are there and you really smell cinnamon and you think about adding it to something else, when you just see it as a whole beautiful world on its own and you add it to something else, it becomes alive for you. Spices, I think, just got all mushed together. And the other problem with spices is people often buy spices, they have them in their drawer, and guess what? They're old, they've been there forever, the essential oils have dropped off, they're like dust. You know, they're not very interesting, what people have in their, you know, they get them, they have them for posterity. They could leave them to their grandkids. They're just awful, you know, so they don't like replenish them or get a small amount. And if you get them, ground up, if you get it's really all over, you know, the oil, because the oil goes. The minute you break it up, the oil goes. And if they sit there, the oil goes. Was one of the things that was completely fascinating that I read about spices. I don't know if you saw this in the book. It was completely interesting. When they did all those old herbals, you know, those beautiful old books, and they had a real mishmash too. They'd have like herbs and spices and resins. All this stuff was like all, you couldn't figure out which was which. But when they drew those herbals with those terrific artists, they didn't know what the spices looked like because they never saw them. So they drew anything. You know, so when they saw them, they had no idea what they were because they kind of made it up. They had the herbs growing everywhere, but they had never really seen the spices because they were from, you know, Indonesia or, you know, somewhere far away and they had never seen them. So when they really saw them and really smelt them when they came back on the ships, they had no idea what they were like. Whoa, this is like amazing.
Which is, you know, in this day and age where you go on the internet and you can look at, you know, exactly what all of those places look like, still somehow the spices have the ability to transport to kind of an exotic place in your mind, in your imagination, in a way that, you know, just kind of looking at Indonesia on your computer screen really doesn't. You know, they have an evocative power.
Well, the thing about those two chapters, the chapter about the cinnamon and the chapter about the mint, I conceived of them in my mind as kind of bookends to each other, which is mint was about everything that's like close to home and underfoot and nearby and familiar and authentic. And then the spices are what's, you know, that kind of deliciousness of what's far away. You bring it home and it's special. You know, it's not like everything is a store that's a multiple of one another, but you know, you go somewhere and you get something really special from far away, and then you bring it home and it has all the patina of that special experience for you. The spices are kind of that. And in my mind, all the five smells in the book are pathways. The smells are pathways into these kinds of experiences. So cinnamon is a pathway into the exotic, what's small, what you bring home, what's far away, what's luxury. Mint is what's underfoot, what's nearby, what smells like your home. Frankincense is all about transcendence and spirituality and religious rituals and trees, that whole kind of aspect that you can get to through incense. There's a lot about incense there. And ambergris is about what's curious and has wonder, curiosity cabinets, animal smells from animals, dogs, skunks, us, you know, all the funky, weird things there are about animal smells. And then jasmine is this incredible smell and pathway to beauty. And that was kind of how I thought of the book, of those five smells.
I think that we should probably take some questions. So if anyone has questions...
Hi, I have lots of questions, but I think one I'd like to have you talk about is You started as a therapist that worked with creatives and artists.
Yes.
And now you work with people through essential oils by providing them with perfumes or, you know, fragrances. And can you talk about, is there a connection between your own creativity and what you're offering people to find in their creativity, perhaps, and through the use of a fragrance?
You know, I a lot of colleagues of mine, for example, will ask you, like for custom perfume, for example, they'll ask you questions about your preferences in your life. You know, do you like Paris? Do you like Thailand? Do you like cashmere? Do you like silk? Do you want to go to Berkeley or San Francisco? Whatever. And then they work out what you'd like in a perfume. I don't do any of that. And having been a shrink for 30 years, you'd think I would, but I don't at all. And I don't have any interest in it either. I feel like people come to scent from an animal part in their nature. And so it's not about language. And I love that scent is so far away from language. So the language, the way that people know how to speak about it has to be reached for to be authentic for them. And so I feel like when I create a perfume, I am trying to capture an emotional experience for myself. My little perfumes are about something that something that's moved me. And if I was a painter, I'd be painting. Or if I was a musician, I'd be making music. But instead, I'm making this perfume. And I see it as something, a communication between myself and the person who wears it. And I like staying very small because I like knowing my customers. I like having that relationship. I don't have any interest in growing at all. So I don't want to be any bigger. And so I feel like it resonates with something deep in people, and they tell me that. You know, I can tell. And I can tell by which ones they pick what's going on with them. I can tell all that. And when they come for custom, I really can tell a lot because I think of the perfume. You know, like, for example, here's a great example just came to me. At Valentine's Day, it never fails, a journalist will call me up, and they'll say, we're doing a story for Valentine's Day. We want to ask you this, and here it comes. And I always think, like, oh, God, please don't. It's we want to ask you if this person is this way, like sporty or sophisticated or, you know, a gourmet, what perfume they're going to like. And then they're going to put it in the magazine, like what I've said or some amount of what I've said. And I've said, like, I can't do this because I have no idea. You know, the person who's sporty inside could be like, you know, I don't know what, you know, a ballet dancer, you know, with, I don't know, you know, some half-life is some other thing. You know, I don't know who they really are, but when they come and smell the ingredients, then I know who they are. Like, I see a lot of men, and they all pick florals, a lot of them, but they wouldn't pick them if they had to do it by identity. So I find that when people interact with smells and are really there in a real way and are smelling the ingredients, all kinds of interesting things come out.
It seems like it really links into all the work you did with people exploring their own creativity and the learning that you had so that you can sort of do it intuitively when someone shows up.
Yes, I do. But it's very important to me to not force anything on anyone. I feel like perfume is so filled with marketing. People are so lost from all the marketing that I feel like they have to arrive at it on their own. So I do a lot of, I think I did this as a shrink too, stripping away of that so they can get to their own real experience with the smells, which will really stay with them and give them something. So I'm very, you know, I try very hard to get them there, like with the cinnamon, to get them really there and so they can have that pleasure.
When you figure out what to make for someone, it's not through words. You literally will have them smell things and watch their reaction and know what you want to make for them.
When I do a perfume, like I do these custom perfumes, they're one of my favorite things I do. They're also the most expensive ones. So people come to my studio. I have a studio in Berkeley. They come to my studio and they get to smell the top notes, the middle notes, and the bass notes. I kind of start with the most normal, easy to like ones. And then I keep moving along to weirder and weirder to see if they're coming with me, you know, and then they get to choose the ones they like the best. I put them on those little scent strips. And then I only will put on the scent strips something they love. So if it's iffy or polite or whatever, I don't. So they have a little configuration of the tops, the middles, and the bases, and then they rank them. So they're very familiar with all that. And I watch, and usually, because scent is so connected to memory, they tell me all about their life. I don't ask them anything, but they tell me their whole life story because they smell this thing and it's like their first boyfriend or a motorcycle rider, their grandmother, whatever. It all comes out, but I don't ask any of that from them. And when they come, they'll often say to me, which is kind of interesting because they're only have smelled synthetic stuff usually. So they'll come and they'll say, well, you know, can I bring stuff? And I always say, what you have, what you like, I don't have, and what I have, you've never heard of, so don't bring anything. And then they want to tell me, you know, don't have me smell patchouli because I hate patchouli, but I do like tuberose. So I always make sure they can't read the labels because they've so never smelled the good versions of things that and then I really love when they smell the patchouli and they really like it and they said, don't give me the patchouli. Then they say, well, what was that? And I say, oh, that was patchouli. And then you can just see, you know, the world opening up. It's very fun. Very fun for me.
Mandy, if you can take a second to just explain to everybody mm-hmm. about the chef's essences, that would be great.
Yeah. I have one of my feet in the food world. And through our book and, you know, working for a while, I have this little line, everything of mine is little, called Chef's Essences, which are the exact same materials I use in the perfume, but they're edible. So I brought some tonight, and they've been so kind as to have some really terrific chocolate. So you're going to be able to spray them on your little pieces of Valrhona chocolate and water. But I'm going to, like, walk you through what's there. So I brought the pear, which was a question, which is a constructed isolate, which is really lovely. And then I brought the cinnamon, which is great on chocolate. I don't think it's so great in water, personally. I brought something called yellow mandarin, which is just divine. It's this very floral, almost bergamot-y floral citrus. I brought blood orange. I brought jasmine, which is better in chocolate than it is in water, but you could put it in water. And for the, you know, the weird one, the difficult one, which I, of course, couldn't leave home. I think there may be one more that I've forgotten. Oh, fresh ginger, out of this world. My favorite, take to a desert island. It's from the wet rhizome. It's from the wet root of ginger. So it's like the kind that you scrape on Thai food and stuff. It's not dried ginger that's kind of heavy and dark. It's bright and very citrusy ginger. Then I brought frankincense, which is odd and interesting. And it's resiny and a little balsamic. And the thing to do is just do one spritz, okay? Don't do more than one, because then you're going to think you don't like it, because they're strong. They're diluted in organic alcohol, so you just give them a little spritz. They're going to help you, and then you can eat the little chocolates and the water. And what happens is you get the aromatic experience with the taste. And it, y'all, honestly, I couldn't make my point about any of this stuff better than having you spritz it on chocolate. Truly.
Okay, well, everyone, join me in thanking Mandy and Daniel. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was founder of Aftelier Perfumes, Mandy Aftel, whose book is Fragrant, The Secret Life of Scent. She was joined in conversation by chef and restaurateur Daniel Patterson. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.